Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Jane Draycott, a lecturer in classics at the University of Glasgow. This is episode CCV, Cleopatra's Daughter. With the death of Cleopatra and Antony, Octavian is left with the dilemma of what to do with their children. On one hand, you shouldn't take your anger out on innocent children, but then again, unchecked, they could eventually prove to be a threat. Dr. Draycott has published a new book on what happened to their daughter, Cleopatra Selene, how she became a prisoner of Rome, survived into adulthood, and became a queen in the ancient world. Here's Jane Draycott.
Cleopatra Selene was the daughter of Cleopatra VII, the last Ptolemaic queen of Egypt, and Marcus Antonius, the Roman consul, the triumvir. And she is an interesting historical figure because she managed to triumph over a considerable amount of adversity, the death of her parents, the deaths of her brothers, the loss of her kingdom to Rome, and become queen of an entirely different kingdom and rule that successfully alongside her husband and her son for the rest of her life.
So can we look at the start of her story, the context of her birth? That sounds like a terrible way to put something like this, but Cleopatra Selene's story begins really with Antony and Cleopatra, the hope and intentions that her parents really had for her. So can you tell me about that part of her story? What sort of life was she intended to lead?
So there are a couple of different ways that you can look at her conception, birth, childhood, early life. And from the Roman perspective, it's all quite sleazy. Antony is married first to Fulvia, a Roman matron, when he initially starts his relationship with Cleopatra, impregnates her, and the twins Alexander Helios and Cleopatra Selene are born in around 40 BCE. And his relationship with Cleopatra continues after Fulvia's death and into his next marriage, which is to Octavia, the sister of Octavian, who would later become Augustus. And so from the Roman perspective, this is utterly scandalous that Antony is cheating on his respectable Roman wives, having a relationship with a foreigner, with a Ptolemy, a queen, an incestuous one because she's married both her brothers in succession, because that's what the Ptolemaic dynasty do. So the children are seen as something quite shameful, these illegitimate, un-Roman children that Antony has fathered. From the Egyptian perspective, however, it's quite different because as far as the Egyptians seem to be concerned, Cleopatra was married to Julius Caesar when she had Caesarion, and she's married to Antony when she has the twins and their younger brother, Ptolemy Philadelphus, subsequently, or at least in a relationship that is akin to a marriage, a divine marriage. And Cleopatra's children are seen as the future of the Ptolemaic dynasty, the hope of Egypt. We see in the archaeological record from Egypt in this period that Cleopatra and Caesarion are ruling together. I mean, of course, Cleopatra is older and senior, and Caesarion is a child, so she's sort of really ruling alone, but technically she's ruling alongside Caesarion. And towards the end of the 30s BCE, we do see Caesarion starting to step into his own ruling. So the plan was for him to grow up and rule Egypt as its pharaoh, as its king. And because Cleopatra Selene was the only female Ptolemy of her generation, I think it's fair to say that she would probably have been expected to marry him and rule alongside him.
Mm.
So when Antony is allocating his children territories during the donations of Alexandria, he gives Cleopatra Selene Crete and the Cyrenaica, which are very physically close to Egypt, implying that she was not really going very far away. Whereas her twin brother and their younger brother, they're given territories much further away. So clearly they're expected to go out of Egypt to other places. Alexander Helios is even betrothed to a Median princess. So that's what their future is. So the four children collectively being the future of the Ptolemaic dynasty, the way that Cleopatra was going to restore the Ptolemaic territory to what it had been when the kingdom was first created, when Ptolemy I Soter, Ptolemy II, Philadelphus were ruling, and the Ptolemaic kingdom was at its first extent. It was an empire all around the Eastern Mediterranean. And so that seems to be the hope for both for Cleopatra, looking at it from an Egyptian perspective, and also Antony looking at it from a Roman perspective, because as he is in charge of the eastern provinces, it makes sense for him to have stable client kingdoms around the eastern periphery of the Roman Empire. And he has put a lot of kings and queens in place in their kingdoms. And the only thing that's really different about Egypt is that he's directly related to these future rulers. So from his perspective, this is a good thing for Rome, because of course they're going to be loyal. They're part Roman themselves, that he is their father, his sons and daughters are their half siblings. And so he's ensuring that the next generation of rulers in the East are going to be very pro-Rome.
So can we make any assumptions about her upbringing then, whether she would have been trained with the expectations that she is going to be a ruler in some capacity? Given her parentage, I assume there would be at least multiple languages that she would have been fluent in, or at least taught those kind of things.
Yes, we know that Hellenistic rulers tended to be very well educated, not just in Egypt, but in the other dynasties as well, the Seleucids, for example. We know that the royal families spent a huge amount of money on their libraries, providing patronage to scholars from all around the ancient world, you know, attracting them to come to Alexandria and to Pergamum as well. We know that Cleopatra herself was well educated. She spoke multiple languages. She was apparently the first Ptolemy to learn Egyptian in amongst all the other languages that she spoke. We know that she was very interested in botany, pharmacy, toxicology. We have accounts from Plutarch of her doing things with poisons, and Pliny the Elder as well. So she seems to have been a very well-educated woman, and as well as being very experienced at statecraft and diplomacy and politics and things like that. And it would be sensible in those circumstances to raise your children to be likewise. And certainly they would have been raised at a very sophisticated court. We know that Caesarion spent part of his childhood in Rome, for example, and it's not beyond the realms of plausibility that when Cleopatra was traveling around the ancient Mediterranean, because we know she went to Rome, we know she went to Syria, Judea, places like that, it's not beyond the realms of plausibility that she took her children with her. And as they grew older, and especially because, as I said before, Caesarion is, by the time the story is coming to an end, he is actually ruling in a semi-autonomous way. So they were presumably witnesses to diplomatic embassies, religious ceremonies like the dedication of the Apis bull, the Bucchus bull. We have inscription evidence attesting to their presence there. So the children would have been very well educated intellectually, but also with the sort of practical vocational skills that they would have needed to be kings and queens later in their lives.
So to move the story along a bit, when Octavian conquers Egypt, one of the dilemmas that he has after the death of Antony and Cleopatra is what to do, crudely put, with their children, because they are both valuable alive, but threats to his power as well, just simply by their parentage and who they are. So can you fill in the story at this point? I think Antony and Cleopatra have three children, and then there's Caesarion, Cleopatra's eldest son, plus a couple of Antony's sons don't fare entirely well, I believe. So can you fill in those gaps then for me? What do the records tell us about the fate of Antony and Cleopatra's children?
So there are two types of fate that the children experience. And the older children, that is Caesarion, Marcus Antonius Antyllus, who is Antony's oldest Roman son, they are in their mid to late teens at this point, and both Caesarion and Antyllus have gone through the Egyptian and Roman, respectively, sort of manhood ceremonies. So they have been declared adults by Cleopatra and Antony. They have been declared their heirs, and that makes them incredibly vulnerable, because by declaring them to be adults, they're declaring them to be threats. And of course, in Octavian, we're dealing with somebody who had himself followed that exact trajectory when he was in his late teens. His great uncle, Julius Caesar, had died, been assassinated, and he made Octavian his heir. And Octavian, in his late teens, became Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus. He was given control of Caesar's fortune. He was given control of Caesar's soldiers and veterans. And he was given the role of the sort of keeper of Caesar's flame as the person who would avenge him. So Octavian knows full well what can happen when you have young men who feel the need to follow in their parents' footsteps, avenge their parents. Realistically, it's not unreasonable for him to look at Caesarion and Antyllus and see versions of himself. And also, I mean, he's only really a historical footnote, but Antony's stepson, Gaius Gravonius Curio, who is the son of Antony's wife Fulvia and her previous husband, Gaius Gravonius Curio, he is on Antony's side in the civil war, and he is executed by Octavian as well. Anybody really with this sort of close connection to Antony and the possibility that they might be a threat after Antony's death has to go. The other children, so Antony has another son, Iulus, and Iulus is younger, and he's back in Rome, and he's being raised in the household of Octavia, Antony's ex-wife at this point. Antony hasn't really been involved in his life for most of his childhood. So he can be somewhat discounted at this point. And then we have Cleopatra Selene, Alexander Helios, Ptolemy Philadelphus. The twins are 10 and Ptolemy Philadelphus is 6. So they are very definitely children. And Octavian could have murdered them, but that's harder, I think, to justify and explain away than it is to adult male sons. He doesn't murder them. He retains them. And he, more importantly, he retains control of them. He takes them back to Rome with him. He keeps them in his house alongside their half-brother, Iulus, and their half-sisters, Antonia the elder, Antonia the younger, Antony's daughters with Octavia. So he collects Antony's surviving children and he essentially raises them as a kind of a foster father, Octavia as a foster mother, Livia, Drusilla on the periphery as well. And they are part of this extended Roman family. And they are a way for him to display himself as a respectable Roman paterfamilias, the uncle who can step in the absence of his nephews and nieces paterfamilias. But it's also politically quite calculating because as long as the children are alive, they are the nominal heirs to the Ptolemaic throne. And nobody else can realistically challenge them because, well, Cleopatra doesn't have any more children. Her siblings are all dead. As far as we know, there are not any extraneous Ptolemies wandering around. The Ptolemaic dynasty has definitively come to an end, really, in this sort of political sense. And that's good for him. He doesn't have any rivals to argue with his control of Egypt, Rome's possession of Egypt. And as long as he can keep control of the children and keep them on side, then that will continue to be the case. And he's an intelligent man. He's a practical man. Juba, as I mentioned earlier, was an extraneous royal child. Numidia was no longer a kingdom. It was a province, but Juba was kept alive and he was brought up Roman and thoroughly Romanized, educated, spoke Latin and Greek and was a scholar and did all the things that young Roman men do. That had turned out quite well for Juba and for everybody else. So there's no reason why Octavian can't do the same, in his view, with Cleopatra Selene, Alexander Helios, Ptolemy Philadelphus. He is working with good ingredients. You know, these are children who are in all likelihood intelligent, well-educated, sophisticated, and young enough, importantly, to be perhaps re-educated for the benefit of Rome.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be some long-term thinking there on his part. But can we back it up narratively just slightly? One thing that we jumped over is the fact that he did march at least the twins in his triumph. Can you talk me through what that might have been like?
Yes. I mean, remember, they're not normal 10-year-olds. They are royal 10-year-olds. So they have been in public spectacle for their whole lives. We know about Antony's sort of pseudo-triumph in Alexandria after he conquers the kingdom of Armenia and the donations of Alexandria. Those are in the historical record, but there would have been plenty of other occasions as well where the children were part of big public spectacles with political, religious, social significance. So they're not entirely inexperienced in this matter. But of course, the feeling of this would probably be very different from being a member of a royal family and being the stars of the show in a positive way in Egyptian spectacles to being the stars of the show in a somewhat less positive way in the Roman triumph that is celebrating Octavian's defeat of their parents, the deaths of their parents, the seizure of their kingdom, all of their family's possessions on display in the parade, placards with painted images of the royal palace, the library at Alexandria, the grand temples of Egypt, the pyramids, etc., on display for the sort of Roman crowd rubberneckers. So that would have been, I think, a very strange experience for them. It was, in some ways, their official introduction into Rome. But at the same time, it sort of marked really the end of their Egyptian life, because after this triumph in which they are displayed alongside an effigy of their mother, they are then expected to slot into everyday Roman life. So that would have been a very dramatic experience for them and probably somewhat emotionally distressing for them. But again, as royal children, they would have been raised to be self-controlled in the face of the public. We can perhaps find analogies in our recent history where royal children have been on display to the general public at times of great emotional distress for them. And they have managed to do it in a very reserved way.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Keep calm and carry on. Yeah. Okay, so as you alluded to earlier, she is married to Juba II, and they are sent as husband and wife to rule over the client kingdom. Is that a fair way to label it, of Mauritania?
Yes. I mean, we could call it the client kingdom, we could call it the allied kingdom, but it is basically a kingdom on the southern western border of the Roman Empire, providing a buffer between Rome and the African continent.
I see this as a very smart, calculating move of Augustus, because here are two members of his household, essentially, who are thoroughly Romanized, that are being sent to rule over what could otherwise be a problem at some point. At the same time, while all of this is involved, do you want to weigh in? Do you have a theory on what happened to her brothers, who we never hear from at this point? I mean, we don't hear much about Cleopatra Selene in the historical texts as it is, but her brothers are not mentioned at all.
We can read between the lines here. So Ptolemy Philadelphus, who is six when everything happens, he is not mentioned as having walked in the triumph alongside his older sister and brother. Reading between the lines, it seems like he died some point before the triumph in 29 BCE. And he's six, you know. Little children have very poor immune systems and they get every bug that's going. And he was transplanted from the very sort of healthy climate of Alexandria to the very unhealthy climate of Rome. And malaria is endemic. It's probable that he fell victim to some kind of illness.
Based on the fact that if he was alive, you think he would have been marched in the triumph as well?
Yes, exactly. There's no reason for Octavian to keep the children alive for a year and then murder the baby before his grand parade. That just doesn't really make logical sense. So as far as Alexander Helios is concerned, we don't really know. I mean, the mention of him in the triumph is the last mention we have of him. So he could have died at any point after that onwards, really, because it's another 5 years before Cleopatra Selene is married to Juba. And there's no mention of Alexander Helios being married or betrothed to anybody in this time. So again, we have this sort of possible, probable that he died too of something mundane, some kind of childhood illness, because the historical record records that Caesarion very specifically was executed, Curio, as I said earlier, and Antyllus was murdered. The fact that the historians go to the trouble of recording those things implies that if Alexander Helios had been murdered too, especially in Rome, once he'd been in the Triumph and once he'd been in the imperial household and he'd been in Rome, it would be something that you would think with greater mention. Likewise, if he had lived and gone on to have some kind of political or military career, or even just an embarrassingly useless life in which he spent his time drinking and consorting with ne'er-do-wells, things like that, that would rate a mention because it would be another way of putting the boot into Antony and Cleopatra. Mm. So I think we, again, just have to sort of infer that he died a fairly ordinary, mundane death. It's a shame that we don't know more.
I thought a good way to start talking about this next phase in Cleopatra Selene's life is to get you to read out, if you have it handy, the epigrams that we have, the first of which was to commemorate her marriage to Juba.
Okay, let me find it. The index is useful. Great bordering regions of the world, which the full stream of Nile separates from the black Ethiopians, you have by marriage made your sovereigns common to both, turning Egypt and Libya into one country. May the children of these princes ever again rule with unshaken dominion over both lands.
That's a very loaded epigram. I can't imagine that Augustus would have been the biggest fan of it. But it speaks of the hope of this young married couple. So who's the epigram written by?
This is by Crinagoras of Mytilene.
I gather he was a fan?
Well, he is something of an unofficial court poet to the entire Julio-Claudian family at this point. He writes another epigram, for example, about one of Cleopatra Selene's half-sisters and sort of praise for her successful pregnancy and childbirth. So he writes about other members of the imperial family as well. So he's not specifically a fan of Cleopatra Selene. He's a fan of Augustus and his entire household and is writing enthusiastic, some might say, obsequious poetry for them.
Okay, and can you speak about the hope, what they meant to the kingdom and the region? Many people would have seen this as a bit of a homecoming in the area, I guess, but at the same time, these are very clearly Augustus's people that are coming to rule over the land.
Yes, we look at this from the Roman perspective, in which isn't it a great idea to send these two young people with North African heritage to rule on behalf of Rome in this Roman-created kingdom? And to the Romans, this was a genius solution, a way of making use of these two people. And obviously, that's true. I mean, the newly created single kingdom of Mauritania, it had Greek settlements, Roman settlements. It was very closely related to provinces of Hispania, just across the straits. So this is actually, in some ways, very neat and tidy, having the Numidian prince and the Egyptian princess, who is also half Roman. They're both very interested in Greece and Greek history and literature and culture, as well as Roman and Latin literature. So they can, between the two of them, sort of cover a lot of bases of the inhabitants of their kingdom. But at the same time, we do have to remember that in addition to all of the Greeks and Romans and Egyptians and whoever else was living in Mauritania, we also have indigenous African people from various tribal groupings. And they seem to have been somewhat less happy about this. We do know that Juba spent a lot of his time seeing off incursions from the Garamantes, the Gaetulians, and other groups whose names were given in the Roman historical record. But the groups themselves, they don't have their own version of the story. So we're seeing a very sort of Roman view of all of this. And so it is a demonstration of imperialism. It is a demonstration of colonialism. And we do sort of have to be aware that just because Juba and Cleopatra Selene were North African, they weren't Mauritanian. They may not have been viewed positively by all of their subjects, but of course they brought with them a lot of celebrity, glamour, sophistication. They provided new buildings and religious practices. We start to see Egyptian religion taking hold in this period, and we start to see a lot of new scholarship being produced because Juba and Cleopatra Selene obviously have access to Greek and Latin literary collections, but also the African one, the Punic ones as well.
And when you say that she became a queen, how important was she to the people? Was she a queen in her own right? Was she a queen by association? I'm just wondering how much power you believe she had.
It's hard to say for certain because ancient Roman historical sources in this period are more concerned with what's going on in Rome than they are anywhere else in the Roman Empire or on the periphery, as Mauritania was in the northwest of Africa, where roughly today we have Morocco and Algeria. But I think it's safe to say that Cleopatra Selene was extremely important in that region. She and her husband, Juba, he was Gaius Julius Juba. He was the son of King Juba of Numidia. And he was, upon Juba's death and the seizure of Numidia and its conversion into a province, he was taken to Rome and he was raised as a Roman. So when the pair of them were married and appointed client king, client queen of Mauritania by Augustus, they were sent to a region that had not previously really been Romanized. It had been two separate kingdoms ruled by separate royal families. And after the death of both of those kings, Augustus amalgamated the territory into one kingdom, really. And he gave Juba and Cleopatra Selene this massive expanse of territory with a very diverse multicultural population and expected them to control it, modernize it, Romanize it, allow Rome to access its natural resources and keep it stable in the interests of Rome. And this is something that they managed to do seemingly very well, because we don't hear about any real strife or turmoil in the kingdom. We don't hear about any problems in the royal family, any coups, any assassinations, anything like that. It seems that the pair of them worked together very well. And although the histories tend to focus primarily on Juba, where they mention Mauritania because he was the king and the Roman political system favored men over women, if we look at the archaeological record, we can see that Cleopatra Selene had a very strong presence indeed. And in fact, of the two of them, she was the one who was better known, more important, more prestigious. She was directly related to the Julio-Claudian imperial family, both through her paternal grandmother, Julia, who was related to Julius Caesar, and through her half-sisters, Antonia the Elder and Antonia the Younger, who were Augustus's nieces. And so she was directly related to the emperors that followed Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero. And so the archaeological record, primarily her coin issues, which she has her own autonomous coinage, it's covered in references to herself and to Egypt, and the architectural evidence from Mauritania, which shows a lot of Egyptian influence, particularly Isle Caesarea, the new capital city, was very much modeled on Alexandria. All of these things imply quite strongly that Cleopatra Selene was not just a cipher, but she was in fact ruling alongside Juba, had a very strong opinion and influence in what was going on in the kingdom at that time.
And it seems that there is payoff from Augustus's intentions, as in they, I don't know if modernize is the correct word, but they definitely seem to increase the level of Romanization in the area. And they renamed the capital, they refound it to honor Augustus. So from that aspect, I think Augustus is justified in his decision.
I think it's very important to note that when their son Ptolemy dies, he's executed by Caligula, the kingdom is seized and is turned into provinces. And clearly Juba and Cleopatra Selene and then later Ptolemy were ruling the kingdom sufficiently well, making it work, that in their absence, it wasn't seen as feasible to keep it going as a kingdom anymore. Ptolemy supposedly had children, and the same thing could have been repeated. The children raised to be very pro-Roman and then returned to the kingdom to rule it. But that wasn't something that Claudius chose to do. He chose to turn the kingdom into provinces. I think that says something about how much of a vacuum was left once Juba and Cleopatra Selene and Ptolemy were removed. This kingdom was no longer viable without them there.
Okay, so we've got Cleopatra Selene dying quite young, really. She dies at the age of 35, quite young by our standards, but probably not unexpected in the ancient world.
Absolutely. And because she dies around about the age that she does, we don't have details about her death and her cause of death. We can again infer that a possibility here is childbirth, because that was the most dangerous thing that a Roman woman, or ancient woman of any kind, actually, the most dangerous thing that they could do was to be pregnant and have a baby. Again, because we don't have those details, if it had been some kind of coup, murder, assassination, something dramatic, you'd think it would be mentioned.
But we do, having said that, get another lovely epigram. So did you have that one handy? Do you want to read that one out for us?
The moon herself, rising at early eve, dimmed her light, veiling her mourning in night, because she saw her namesake, pretty Selene, going down dead to murky Hades. On her she had bestowed the beauty of her light, and with her death she mingled her own darkness.
You know, I feel that if this man, Crinagoras, is ever in a movie on Cleopatra Selene's life, that this would be played by Elton John or somebody similar, yeah, perhaps. It strikes me as that kind of, you know, candle in the wind kind of vibe, this one.
No, absolutely. And for, I suppose, similar reasons, this is somebody who had had a very dramatic life with high highs and low lows and had achieved amazing things, but ultimately died quite prematurely and somewhat tragically, leaving behind her husband, her young children, her unfinished work in the kingdom.
To finish off this story, I'm very impressed that you not only decided to write a book on this and got it published, which is quite an undertaking, so congratulations on that front.
Thank you.
But that you managed to write a book on, I don't want to say on so little, but we have limited historical sources on Cleopatra Selene. So how much of a challenge was it for you to write your book? And what did you try to bring to the story?
Again, I think it's a matter of perspective, to be honest, because we have more evidence for Cleopatra Selene and all aspects of her life than we do for, say, Boudicca. And how many books have been written about Boudicca? And I'm not saying they shouldn't have been. I'm just saying that it's sort of, really, we do actually have quite a lot of information about Cleopatra Selene, more information than many other historical figures that receive attention. I think it's more to do with the way that in the past, up until quite recently, scholars, historians have chosen to focus their attention on certain things in relation to antiquity. There are plenty of new stories that can be told using old evidence. They just haven't been looked at in a particular way. And so I think what I tried to do with the book was use the ancient evidence, the ancient literature, the documentary evidence, the archaeological evidence, even bioarchaeological evidence in some cases. So I tried to use the specific evidence that we have for Cleopatra Selene. And around that, think about the context and bring the context into it in perhaps a slightly different way. Thinking about what it would have been like for a young Egyptian princess to no longer be an Egyptian princess, looking at what was the Roman view of Egypt at that time, and what were people writing about Egypt in poetry during the Augustan principate? What kind of material culture was using Egypt in this period? And what would someone who came from Egypt looking at that, what would they think of that? How would they feel? Cultural appropriation, I suppose we would call it today, with our current sort of 21st century post Black Lives Matter, post the death of Queen Elizabeth II, and this sort of thoughts about, well, what does the Commonwealth actually do? Take a little bit of that mindset and look at this particular ancient story and ask new questions because of the way that we're thinking. We can think about similar situations in the past. And I thought I had a story that was worth telling, and certainly one that was not as widely known as it perhaps could or should be.
That was Dr. Jane Draycott, lecturer in classics at the University of Glasgow, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this episode, then check out Jane's book, Cleopatra's Daughter, is available now from all good book retailers. Emperors of Rome is on the socials. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Jane is at JL Draycott. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, we're taking the timeline forward to the 3rd century CE and the rule of Gallienus. This podcast is produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.